Hi, I'm Josh Rushing, filling in for Femi Oke in this week's bonus edition of the stream, where you get a special look at the conversations we have with our guests after the live show ends. Coming up, we'll take you behind the scenes to hear extras from this week's conversation about Brazilian politics and the Amazonian environmental crisis, as well as an Instagram Live with one of the founders of the Women's March in the U.S. But first, let's go to El Salvador. In the live show, we debated whether the country's democracy is under threat. Now, after the broadcast ended, I shared this authoritarian checklist with our guest. Some of the indicators of authoritarianism include muzzling the media, eliminating political rivals, expanding domestic surveillance, and keeping the country in a perpetual state of war or revolution. And I wanted to know, how many of these does El Salvador check off? But my guest, Paul Steiner, took issue with the list itself. Here's what he had to say.
But whose recipe is that?
This is from something, it's a post-World War II, I can actually pull up the site, it's called Post-World War II Germany, but it's been accepted as kind of a general checklist for authoritarian, building authoritarian governments.
You can't set a set of rules like that and assume that everybody starts from the same position. When you start
is it true or not that Bukele checks most of these points? Is it true or not that Bukele checks most of these
points? You can't say
yes or no question. Does Bukele check most of these points? He does, right? He does.
No,
this is a style of government.
It depends on the starting point. Look, Jose, you better than anybody else as a lawyer know, having worked for both a right-wing lawyer and a left-wing government, you more than anybody should be able to know that the judiciary is a real mess.
We have
650 judges, of which...
Let's let Paul finish, and then I'll give you the mic, okay? Paul, say your bit, and then we're going to go to Jose.
We have over 650 judges that have failed the judiciary exam at least once, and 10% of them have failed it every time they've taken it. We have a section in charge of supervising the judiciary, and they don't. They've been shut down for years. Even the section that's in charge of monitoring the lawyers has been shut down for years. And the whole thing about it is that the magistrates of the Supreme Court have been elected by political parties to suit their financial providers, who are the people that they control. So nobody can argue that.
Well, Paul, let's see if what you just said is true. Can anyone argue that? Jose, would you argue with that?
Well, I think Paul is acknowledging that it is the government who is sacking the judges through the legislature, of course. But I think this is an important recognition and acknowledgement that it is the government that is sacking a third of all judges.
But he's justifying it by saying that they're failing this judiciary test, that the judiciary has been a mess for years.
No, and this is an issue we've taken to several forums and also media outlets, because we are very worried about judicial independence, in particular because this law, which basically sacks any judge that is over 60 years of age or 30 years of service, or has 30 years of service, has absolutely no rationale related to corruption,
which is the stated policy purpose of the government.
Paul, wait. We listen to you. Let's listen to Jose here.
No, Paul was trying to argue that this is all done in the benefit cleaning up the judiciary. But you have to remember that this move is preceded first by the sacking of the Constitutional Court in El Salvador. Not only were they sacked, but five people were imposed as acting justices to the Constitutional Court. This basically means that the government, Bukele's government, controls the head of the judiciary. Second step is now the sacking of a third of all judges with absolutely no linkage to corruption in terms of policy objectives. Why? Why do I say this? Because it only cuts clear in terms of age, not in terms of merit, not in terms of possible corruption allegations, not in terms of performance. No, it's just a clear cut in terms of
Jose,
age.
Let me take that back to Paul. When you said that all these judges are failing tests, are those the judges that are being removed, or is it just the judges that are over 60?
Okay, Jose is making a point about sacking the judges. What the president has done is he has forced a space where he has established, or the Congress has established a law that says that when you reach 60 or 30 years of service, you come up for retirement, and that it's an obligatory retirement unless the court, all 15 magistrates, decide that you're valuable and you're going to stay. So they're not automatically sacked. The court has a complete...
Are those the magistrates you said that were appointed by the parties?
I don't want to overstate this, but Paul just said expressly, word by word, the president has decided. You see, this is not something for the president. Yeah, no, I understand.
I'm not in a courtroom here, Jose.
No, I understand, Paul.
And sometimes you make a conversation where you start in the conversation, so you correct yourself along the way.
I understand. But do you acknowledge or do you not acknowledge that this is a decision coming from the president himself?
Let me ask you two questions to answer that one.
My question answered first. I have three questions before that you never answered.
First of all, is there a mechanism for taking those judges out if they are bad?
Yes, they are. There is.
Does that mechanism work?
Well, no, honestly, it hasn't worked as well as it should. But
what is the executive doing mingling
with the sacking of judges in the judiciary?
So Paul Jose's point is, why is the executive mingling in the judiciary anyway? And again, you keep pointing to bad judges, but it doesn't seem like bad is one of the requirements for being removed from the bench. It seems like age is the requirement.
That's the only way to create a space for the Supreme Court to act and put the right people in the right place. Look, what we have here
is a space for very loyal judges who will replace those 250
and the progressives who want change. And the majority of the population is behind the progressives who want change. The problem is that once you've lost political power and you're starting to lose economic power, then you've got very little to lose. I'm sure the dinosaurs also screamed really, really loud when the meteorite came.
I'm actually going to give you the last word there, Paul, because I've run out of time. John, you want to jump in just for a second, and then we got to cut this.
Yeah, no, I was just going to put that into a bit of a context. We spoke to judges. There was a march of them the week we were in El Salvador, and I actually asked them, has there been corruption in the judiciary? And all of them answered, yes, there has been corruption in the judiciary. What they were arguing with is the way in which they were being taken out, that those over 60 were going to be forcibly retired. Now, Paul, on the one hand here, is saying, well, that's the only way because the mechanisms to get them out weren't working. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they were saying there has to be some sort of protocol apart from age. Otherwise, this is just completely random. So I think you can't
self-regulation
that
never
point of view.
No,
why is the president not establishing ways to get judges out that aren't just linked sort of with the factor of age?
I want to share with you now a few moments from our Instagram live series. Earlier this week, I spoke with Sarah Sophie Flicker, an artist, activist, and organizer of the Women's March. We spoke about the latest attack on women's reproductive rights in Texas, as well as the ways that art and storytelling play a critical role in activism. I'm always so inspired by artists and curious about what drives their creativity, so I asked Sarah where she finds her muse.
For me, it's always been really about like things that I want to change in the world, or things that seem patently unfair and horrible. And, you know, I do feel like we often discount culture and its power. And I think a lot of times policy is downstream from culture. And so, you know, it's like, the Women's March, for example, is complicated and there are issues with it, and I have as many issues as anyone else. But when I found out that they were organizing around, you know, reproductive justice and abortion on October 2nd, I was in, because I understand that, like, you know, even with the Supreme Court, we are now stuck with an activist, very biased majority in the Supreme Court. And if millions and millions and millions of people are out marching on October 2nd and saying, like, this is not going to fly with us, they hear that, you know, and that affects the decisions that they can and can't get away with, or what they perceive they can and can't get away with. You know, I also think abortion especially, but really like anything, you know, racial justice, any of it, there's, you know, the right has done a very good job of like sort of encapsulating it in this morality or family values or whatever. And I think that with stuff like this, like they don't get to own that stuff. You know what I mean? Like I am the most family, or I imagine you are too. We are the most family oriented people. Like, so just creating art and creating content and creating TV shows, movies, music, sports, whatever, you know, whatever it is, radio stuff that normalizes how we think about all this stuff is really powerful, you know. And while we may be getting, you know, this country, as we all know, is divided, has been divided historically and now, you know, at this point, we're getting two separate sets of news even, right? Like the facts that one side is getting are totally different from the facts another side is getting. But the thing that, and you can like turn off Fox News or MSNBC or CNN, whatever, but people don't turn off the radio. They still go to sports game. I'm so not a sports games. I know that's not a thing, but you know, they go to theater.
Are you sports game much?
you know, but all of the things that like we look at and hear and smell and touch and see every day, like that influences how we think about politics and each other and each other's humanity. And I think it's really hard to hate someone whose story, you know, so I'm just really a fan of like storytelling and using, you know, art and theater and theatricals, you know, spectacles to make statements, you know, similar to what AOC did on the red carpet of the Met Gala on Monday.
With the dress, tax the rich.
Yeah. Your friend made that dress. And
my wife just yesterday said, you should do an IG live with the woman who made that dress for AOC.
Oh, she's amazing and brilliant and smart and like a beautiful fighter in all things good and that we care about. She's wonderful. But I thought that was really powerful. And I know that, you know, some people didn't like it, but I, you know, whatever, you go onto Twitter and everyone's talking about taxing the rich and people are Googling, what does that mean? You know, what do they mean by rich? You know, it started a national conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's something that policy can't do. You know, so I do believe in cultural organizing. I do believe in like those kinds of direct actions. I believe in beauty. I believe in art. You know, the course's tagline is from a poem by Toy Derricotte, and it is joy is an act of resistance. And I have always held that really close to my heart, because the whole point of all this stuff is to keep us divided and in fear and out of community and too scared to stand up for ourselves. So, you know, no one is meant to fight all the time. You know, there's got to be joy in there. And if you look at any, you know, marginalized group who's been fighting for their survival over generations, like there has to be joy in there. So I think art is like critical in these moments. If you look at the history of abortion, it's so interesting that, you know, a lot of, you know, pushback on abortion originally came from people who owned, in, you know, enslaved people, and would get mad when a Black woman caused herself to, you know, miscarry or whatever, have an abortion effectually, because it was attached to like how profitable that baby would have been. So there's all sorts of like awful, you know, when you get deep into it, it's like all of this hoopla around abortion has as much to do with race and control and power and money as it does with women and gender, you know. So it's all of the things.
Is there a definitive book on abortion that gets into the history of it that you'd recommend?
Yeah, although there's not like one that I can like, I know Elise Hoge, who was the president of NARAL, wrote a really great one last year. There's a great article in today's New York Times that really gets into the way in which the right wing, you know, right wing folks over time from like the 70s to now really weaponized abortion as a way to like create, you know, a right wing coalition. And, you know, the origin story of all that really comes back to like school segregation, which I think most people don't know. So, you know, it's why I really love, like, look into reproductive justice organizations like Sister Song that are all, you know, Black led and tend to do a really amazing job of connecting all the dots between this stuff. So, you know, you see the ways in which, like, what's happening in Texas right now isn't just about abortion. It's also, you know, what is the point, for example, of having the right to choose to have or not have a child if you can't ultimately, like, raise that child without the threat of, like, state violence or poverty or racism or, you know, draconian immigration laws, like whatever it is, it's like all these things are connected. Mm-hmm. And I think the more quickly we all learn to see the ways in which all these things are connected, we can be in better community with each other. We can be better allies to each other. You know, and the thing that, you know, is slowly starting to happen, which I take heart in, is, you know, that people are starting to realize, like, let the people most impacted tell their stories, let them lead on the issues. The people closest to the pain are always closest to the solution. And sometimes, like, for those of us who have a lot of privilege and resources, the best thing we can do is just, like, show up and listen.
Finally, another interview this week that was so good, we had to keep it going. It was about Brazil and the Amazon rainforest. Rampant deforestation has many concerned that the ecosystem is at a tipping point with potentially catastrophic effects, not just for the indigenous groups there, but for the whole world because of climate change. After the broadcast, I ask our guests what kind of pressure Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro responds to. They were pretty direct in their answers.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
I don't think we are having a president that actually have a project for the country. So he has a project to stay in power in charge, and I think
I'm sitting in a country where they impeached their president twice last administration, and it didn't make any difference. So I'm not sure that's the answer either.
Okay. I think Bolsonaro responds very clearly to internal economic interests. So the agribusiness is very heavy. It was very heavy on funding his campaign. So I think he responds to that kind of pressure. He wants to put Brazil back on the economic map of the world, and he knows that that comes from producing more, exporting more, even if it's at the cost of the Amazon.
What were you going to say, Andrea?
But I don't think it's real, you know? I think this is fake news when he reacts to something. Because actually we see him reacting when his family and his sons are being investigated, when he see a threat against his family, you know? And I think the only way is to get him out of the power is to do what the Americans did, you know, not reelecting the problem.
Well, is it all on Bolsonaro, though? Was Lula any better? Has Brasilia been any better under other administrations?
I guess there is a difference between Bolsonaro and any other governor, president that took place in Brazil, which is having a project of destroying these institutions. He has an anti-democratic plan. A strategy, you know, so you can disagree with Lula, with Fernando Henrique, with many other presidents Brazil had, but all of them had a project, had a plan to develop the country, to develop the economy. And Bolsonaro, we can see that in Bolsonaro. He wants to destroy what exists. Mm.
And it's very clear. If you look at last year, we had a document about that was published from the internal auditing from Brazil, from the own government, trying to assess the implementation of the environmental policy. And the own people from the government said, well, we cannot assess the implementation of the environmental policy because there was no strategical planning. There was no planning at all in the environmental ministry. So there is a clear speech against forest, against indigenous people, against legality at some point, saying that we need to change the law and everything. But there is nothing to done to for enforcement, or much less than before.
And just to give an example, he is ruling against the Constitution in many ways, in health, in education, in environment, in cultural policies, in all the policies that you may imagine.
Where's the Supreme Court on this then?
Yes, there are many processes going on, but some Brazilian papers have published. I guess international media has been following this for many years. The number of crimes against the Constitution, that we say crimes of responsibility in Brazil, and there are no excuse for not suing him. So. It's like Alice was saying in the beginning of the show, it's a matter of political will.
And when is his administration up for re-election?
Bolsonaro's administration?
Yeah. When are they up for re-election?
Next year, 2022.
Next year.
And how's he doing in the polls there?
Not bad. Not good.
All right.
Not good. His rejection levels are higher than ever, but he's doing a policy of distributing a budget that should go to health care, to education, and to social assistance, to parliamentaries. Like, he's keeping himself in power by doing the political movement that was able to sustain him for more than 30 years.
And you're dealing with fake news and misinformation there on this issue also, right?
So I think it's important to also stress that Brazilian democracy is very new. So we have 30 years of democracies. And It's important to understand that, but because we are now in a very different situation in terms of social media and how the information is flowing and fake news are being disseminated. And this is actually having an impact on the debate. Like, I was just in a cab today, and the guy just explained to me that COVID-19 doesn't exist, and that people, the government get paid for that. And it's, here in Mato Grosso, it's so common.
Yeah.
People actually believe that COVID-19 is an invention, that deforestation is also an invention. So that's why we need we as NGOs, all the people that are talking about deforestation, we always need to have very strong data, and we always need to be very sure of the information that we are disseminating. And the fact is that we are kind of losing the narrative with those 25% that still support Bolsonaro.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.